tune in to Turn On the News daily from 313.9.org. You can go to newsroom.313.9.org for links to anything you might hear here, including links to international radio art, radio news, media news, links, and more. Go to 313.9 and newsroom.313.9.org for everything you want to know about transmission arts. And to hear Turn On the News daily. I'm Tom Rowe. You're tuned in to Turn On the News, Free 103.9's weekly look at radio art, radio news, media news, sound art, and more. It's a radio show about radio, Turn On the News. And this week we are going to look at the Video Freaks, a Catskill pirate radio collective from the early 70s that claimed to be the first pirate television station. And we'll also listen to the FCC, Congress's hearing on the future of audio and more. So stay tuned to Turn On the News from 3.9. You can go to FREE103POINT9.org for more information about anything you hear here, including links to international sources of radio art, radio news, media news, sound art, and more at newsroom.313.9.org or free103.9.org. The headlines next. First, we head to Computer World, where Jakumar Vijan reports that, quote, opinion appears sharply divided on whether the government and law enforcement should have unchecked authority to initiate a localized or citywide wireless service shutdown for public safety purposes. And he continues, in April, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, issued a notice seeking public comments on the issue. Those comments came in last weekend. They were due May 30th. The FCC has gotten responses from all over, from things like the Bay Area Rapid Transit District in San Francisco last August. They had a controversial decision to temporarily cut off underground cell phone service to commuters in response to a planned protest against the shooting of a homeless man by a Bay Area Rapid Transit police officer. So those are the sort of things that the government is considering, whether they're going to have increased power to shut down all wireless communications, which we're also seeing happen in other parts of the world where there is protests and strife, such as Syria, Iran, China, etc. Over at The Hill, Brendan Sasso is reporting that Representative Jim Legevin, a Democrat from Rhode Island, is making a last-minute push to get Congress to pass the Cyber Intelligence Sharing Protection Act, CISPA, or some version of it. The House passed CISPA in April, and Legevin spoke at the Military Academy at West Point last weekend about there's still, quote, a gulf of opinions about the government's role in protecting private computer networks, a divide that has become, quote, an increasingly daunting barrier to passing comprehensive reforms, he says. You can go to this article at The Hill, see which side folks on Capitol Hill are taking on the issue. Benton.org points us to a FCC press release. New FCC Commissioner Jessica Rosenworkel announced her staff. She's picked Valerie Galasso as confidential assistant and special advisor, and she has lots of telecommunications background. She's also a special assistant for legislative affairs for Vice President Joe Biden recently. She's also worked at Congressional Affairs at the National Telecommunications and Information Administration at the Department of Commerce, and has a Master's of Arts in Public Policy with a concentration in Science and Technology from Johns Hopkins University. The commissioner also has picked Priscilla Delgado Argueris as legal advisor for wireline and consumer issues. She previously worked at a law firm, Wiley Ryan, and has been involved in federal and state communications law. Finally, in headlines, behind us we have the Connet Project, tracking number stations around the world. Finally, headlines, June 15th is Prometheus Radio Project is continuing their tour of cities around the country, the United States, looking for low-power radio possibilities, as the Federal Communication is likely to open a window early next year, 2013, for folks to apply for low-power stations around the country. So their next low-power FM radio clinic is at the NFCB conference in Houston, Texas, Friday, June 15th. Presenters include Vanessa Maria Graber from the Prometheus Radio Project, Sabrina Roach from Brown Paper Tickets, Michael Brown and Betty McArdle from Brown Broadcast Services, Gavin Dahl from KYRS and Common Frequency, and Donna DeBianco from Community Radio, a Community Radio Broadcast Consultant. You can go to prometheus.org for more information about that. Free Speech Radio News has a report interviewing Eva Galperin, the International Freedom of Expression Coordinator at Electronic Frontier Foundation, about the situation in Syria, how the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights and rebels have killed more than 100 government soldiers since last Friday, and violence continues. Syria as government agencies are fighting back increasingly on the internet.
Today, United Nations officials say that Syrian authorities have agreed to allow some humanitarian access to four areas in the country. Those include Daraa, Deir al-Zor, Homs, and Idlib, where government forces have for months launched bombardments and attacks on civilian neighborhoods. Activists with the local coordination committees report more than 40 people were killed in government strikes on Monday. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said rebels killed more than 100 government soldiers since last Friday. As violence continues on the streets in Syria, attacks are also taking place online, as both government agencies and activists turn increasingly to the internet. For more, we're joined by Eva Galperin. She's the International Freedom of Expression Coordinator at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. She's been monitoring cyber tactics in Syria. Welcome to FSRN.
Hi there.
You reported on the increasing number of cyber attacks on activists within Syria, including Trojan spyware that comes via Skype. How does this work?
Well, we've actually been seeing attacks from pro-Syrian government hackers that specifically target activists and opposition members in Syria since approximately January. And we've seen two classes of attack. The first is usually a very typical phishing attack, where you are sent to a website that looks exactly like Facebook or looks exactly like YouTube, encouraged to log in, and then the attackers gather up your login credentials, which gives them access to your private and personal information. And the other is the Trojan attack, which usually include some sort of Trojan spyware, which covertly installs itself on your machine. Usually it logs all of your keystrokes, it collects all of your passwords, it takes periodic screenshots, and then it sends all of that information back to an IP address in Syrian IP space. Most of the Trojan attacks that we have seen all send the information back to the same IP address, which indicates to us that it is all the same person or group of people.
That IP address where this information is going, is it known who's the owner of that or where that's located?
That's actually something that's very hard to establish.
Mm-hmm. You said you've been monitoring these attacks since January. Has there been an increase in the number of attacks? Has there been a pattern of how they're developing?
They've certainly been increasing in frequency and in variety, especially as the Syrian government has become more and more concerned about people who are contacting members of the mainstream press outside of Syria and telling people about what's going on. Those people are definitely being targeted.
Can you talk more about the pro-Assad computer activists who are behind some of these attacks, or what's known about them?
Well, what's interesting about them is really how much is not known. There are at least two groups which are engaged in sort of in targeting of opposition activists in support of the Assad regime. At least one of them is the Syrian Electronic Army, which is not officially affiliated with the Assad regime, but certainly very supportive of it. And as recently as a few months ago, Assad gave a speech in which he publicly acknowledged the Syrian Electronic Army. And the other is this group, which is behind the malware attacks, which does not have a name, and again, is not specifically supported by the Assad regime, but is certainly gathering information that would only be useful to the Assad regime, and are targeting enemies of the regime very specifically.
Is it known how successful these attacks have been, how much information has been gathered, or how disruptive it has been to activist networks?
Well, we do know that activists have been infected with the Dark Comet remote access tool, which is a Trojan which gives the attacker full access to the person's computer, and that information has been sent back to this IP in Syrian IP space, which we find extremely troubling. We do know that that activists have been rounded up; they have been detained. They've been jailed, and occasionally we do know that it is as a result of intelligence that the Assad regime has from their computers, and we find that deeply troubling.
Eva Galperin is the International Freedom of Expression Coordinator at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. She joined us to talk about threats to online freedom and expression in Syria. Thank you for joining us.
All right, thank you.
I'm Timur. You're listening to Turn on the News, a radio show about radio. And we go first to the radio headlines, and Kenan Steiner at the Sunlight Foundation Reporting Group, reporting.sunlightfoundation.com is the website, reports that on Wednesday, June 6th, the U.S. House Subcommittee voted to defund the Federal Communications Commission's initiative announced in April that would provide online access to spending for political ads on some local television stations. Basically, they were rolling out, moving the broadcast file, which is an actual manila folder still, that any member of the public can go to and look at and find out information about the broadcast station and whether it's fulfilled its FCC obligations or not. They've started with the big television stations and saying you've got to put that information online, and eventually we're going to roll it down to the small television stations and the large radio stations and the small radio stations. This is the first step, the big television stations, and first what happened was the National Association of Broadcasters filed a brief in a lawsuit against the ruling. Basically, they'll never win that case, but they will delay the implementation of the online broadcast file. And now, Republicans in the U.S. House are voting to defund the initiative. Meanwhile, the FCC is continuing to go about its work, and Radiosurvivor.com, Jennifer Waits reports about FCC ruling, just announced, with a fine of $50,000 for KUSF and the Classical Public Radio Network, which has taken over CPRN California and kind of monetized that radio frequency. You can read that story by Jennifer Waits at radiosurvivor.com. Reporters Without Borders is reporting that Ethiopia's only ISP, the state-owned Ethio Telecom, has just installed a system for blocking access to the Tor network, which lets users browse anonymously and access blocked websites. And this, they're saying at the same time, the state-owned printing presses are demanding the right to censor the newspapers they print. You can go to Reporters Without Borders and look for the Ethiopia government steps up control of news and information story. Likewise, you can head to South Carolina for not quite a similar situation, but South Carolina Senate is voted in a second reading of House Bill 3508 that will turn over rural broadband responsibilities to AT&T, which has a very poor track record with providing rural broadband and does have no plan for it in South Carolina. You can go to Community Broadband Networks at muninetworks.org for more information about House Bill 3508 in South Carolina. Under us tonight, we're listening to Pansonic and Transmission. Turn on the News, 3.9's radio show about radio, a daily look at radio news, video art, sound art, media news, and more. We're going first to Congress, and we'll see what they think about the future of audio. House Subcommittee on Communications and Technology held a hearing Wednesday, June 6th, called The Future of Audio. And the big discussion was a major record label and a major radio network had just announced a major deal together that, in a different era, might have been called Payola, but was trumpeted by most of the members of the committee, not all. They mostly talked about new technologies, about perhaps leveling the playing field between terrestrial FM radio and new emerging technologies like internet radio, which is charged performance fees that FM radio is not. Mostly, though, you'll hear members of Congress attempt to sound hip by quoting the Rolling Stones. This is the future of audio.
Mr. Stearns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think you've echoed pretty much what I was going to say. Consumers are listening to music that can be chosen from terrestrial radio, HD radio, Sirius XM, satellite radio, cable, Pandora, live radio, YouTube, iTunes, Vivo, Move Music, Rhapsody, and the list goes on. So I think we have competition. One of our witnesses, Gary Shapiro, states in his testimony, we have rapidly shifted to a growing set of choices with a phenomenal array of devices, products, sources, and services. And I had the opportunity to see this recently at the Consumer Electronics Show. And our witness today represent an important competition in the music space, offering consumers an array of choices and musicians new opportunities to gain new audiences. Gone are the days when consumers are limited to radio and just television, and gone too should be the archaic policies of the old era of prohibiting free market decisions. In today's struggling economy, we're looking at a market that is working, and let's keep it that way. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I would now yield to the vice chair of the subcommittee.
Well, I
appreciate that as well. Appreciate your college experience. I also DJ, just not on radio, but parties. Of all weddings, and I'll tell you what, in my time when I had to go to Homer's Music to buy vinyl, it's really hard to find the Flying Dutchman and Homer's Records back in the 70s and early 80s, but on today's digital world, it's a lot easier. Maya, how things have changed since then, and in fact, my three sons, two of them teenagers, only the oldest even cares what a CD is. The other two don't care. It's all about the digital world. It's about organizing their music as they want it and see it, having the devices necessary to play it. And where it goes, I don't know. But I like it, like the Rolling Stones say. Now, I will say that I am intrigued as well with the contract or agreement between Big Machine and Clear Channel. But I need to work through this a little bit more before I have a level of enthusiasm, because I also remember private contracts between radio stations and record labels. That was called payola. And so I don't know where we're going with this, but it is intriguing, and I'll yield back.
Gentleman yields back. Now recognize the ranking member of the subcommittee from California, Ms. Eshoo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning, and welcome to all of the witnesses. More than 90 years ago, Pittsburgh's KDKA launched the nation's first commercial radio broadcast. For decades, AM and FM radio served as the primary source for local news, information, and music for millions of Americans. While I continue to believe that broadcast radio plays an important role in local communities around our country, the Internet has opened up a world of innovation that's driving new business models like on-demand streaming, providing new opportunities for independent musicians, and even expanding the reach of traditional AM and FM stations to audiences not only around the country but around the world. Many of these innovations are being developed in my congressional district in Silicon Valley. Last year, I had an opportunity to visit a Palo Alto startup known as TuneIn. It's headquartered in an old plumbing supply store, which I remember going to when my children were small. They had 40 employees when I was there last year. TuneIn has developed a mobile app featuring over 60,000 AM, FM, HD, and internet radio stations and an active monthly listener base of more than 30 million people. I mean, that's stunning. Just in and of itself. And TuneIn is just one example. Over the past decade, we've seen the emergence of Spotify, Pandora, iHeartRadio, Apple iTunes, Amazon Music Store, Google Music, and Slacker Radio. The significance of these services is, in fact, quite stunning. Last year, within the United States, 52% of record company revenues came from digital sources. So we need to embrace these innovative technologies and not hinder their growth. The future of audio is about enhancing, in my view, consumer choice, whether at home or on the go using smartphones, tablets, or other portable devices. I've always opposed technology-specific mandates, always, because technology moves at the speed of lightning. Before our ink is even dry, the technology has changed. And for that reason, I've always opposed technology-specific mandates, which is why last year I joined with Representative Issa to introduce the Creativity and Innovation Resolution. The resolution asserts that Congress should not mandate specific technology that limits the way consumers listen to local news, information, and music. The resolution has the rare distinction of being endorsed by CEA, CTIA, and RIAA. And I hope my colleagues will join me in supporting this bipartisan resolution. As consumers increasingly stream audio through their mobile devices, I'm also interested in learning whether data caps impact user behavior. While more often discussed in the context of data-intensive video, Users who stream just 1 hour per day of high-fidelity audio through a typical online music subscription service can easily exceed the monthly data package offered by many wireless carriers. This is an issue that rests squarely with our subcommittee's jurisdiction, and I think it's important for us to examine this closely. Mr. Chairman, the future of audio looks bright as consumers have a growing array of options, including online music stores, subscription-based services, satellite radio, and HD radio. So thank you for holding this morning's hearing. We have a great panel, and I'm anxious to hear what they have to instruct us, and I welcome the witnesses again, and thank you for holding the hearing. I don't. Do any of our members want me to yield time? Okay. Yield back, Mr. Chair.
Generally yields back balance for time. Chair recognizes the chairman of the full committee, the gentleman from Michigan, Mr. Upton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. From the radio dramas and fireside chats of the 30s to talk radio and this online streaming of today, audio content has been an integral part of American society for the last century. 20 years ago, the world of audio choices was pretty simple: AM, FM, cassette, CD. The world of audio in 2012 offers so much more. Broadcasters are using digital services to deliver HD radio. Satellites 22,000 miles above the earth provide subscription radio service to millions of Americans. Technological advances make it possible to carry an entire music library in your pocket. And an increasing number of Americans are streaming music over the Internet to their computers and wireless devices. Not only has the ability to access a world of professional audio content gotten so much easier and more universal, the ability for people around the world to produce and distribute their own works over the Internet has changed major industries: music, journalism, entertainment, just to name a few. So today we're going to hear from the broadcasters that are innovating, mobile wireless providers that are making access to media ubiquitous, Internet pioneers that are leveraging the Internet to bring users personalized content channels, and professional artists at the center of it all on how this new media frontier is changing their industries and the way that we listen. I'll be particularly curious to hear, as with Chairman Walden, to hear their reaction to yesterday's announcements by Clear Channel and The Big Machine. It looks to me like an agreement that might break the logjam that has plagued this space and help advance online radio. Best of all, it doesn't require legislation or regulation. So I thank the witnesses, and I don't know if any members on my side.
I think Ms. Blackburn.
Ms. Blackburn, the balance of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to say welcome to all of our witnesses. I enjoy working with each of you on this issue. I think it is vitally important. Audio distribution systems can't be successful without compelling content, and in Nashville, we think that's a really important thing. Likewise, music won't enjoy wide distribution without innovative technologies, and Mr. Shapiro and I continue to have this ongoing discussion. The audio marketplace is constantly evolving, but the music and the technology industries need each other in order to thrive. I believe we can be both pro-intellectual property and pro-innovation. I'm determined that we're going to find a way to do that. And we must be both if we want to grow and be successful, and for our nation's economy, Tennessee's economy, and for our exports, we need to figure this one out. Big Machine Records, which is a Nashville, Tennessee company and a major broadcaster, as Chairman Upton said, did enter into a voluntary agreement with yesterday on the performance rights issue. We are pleased to see that. We're looking forward to more good things. So that the industry does continue to grow in Nashville. We like to say it all starts with the song. We believe it does, and we want to make certain that we figure this one out. Thank you so much. I yield back.
Generally yields back to the chairman. Chairman, do you have anyone else you wanted to yield to? Anyone else on our side? Apparently not. Chairman yields back the balance of his time. Now recognize the former chairman of the committee, the gentleman from California, Mr. Waxman.
Thank you, Chairman Walden, for holding this hearing to examine the future of audio. We live in an era of rapidly changing technologies and consumer behavior. Innovation over the past decade has led to a proliferation of choices in the way consumers access audio content, whether it's new subscription-based streaming services, webcasting, or HD radio offered by traditional over-the-air broadcasters, the dynamic audio marketplace has brought consumers more choices, greater accessibility, and lower prices. As technology advances, it's important that we do not lose sight of the artists, musicians, and songwriters whose work compels consumers to seek out these innovative new services. Thanks to these new technologies, barriers to entering the music market have never been lower, but paradoxically, the number of people who identify themselves as musicians has declined over the last decade. We need to understand why this is happening. Congress has an important role to play in ensuring that singers, songwriters, and other musicians are compensated fairly, both through combating online piracy and ensuring an equitable licensing and royalty system. I'm proud to have co-sponsored the Performance Rights Act during the last Congress. This bill would ensure that musicians are compensated by over-the-air broadcasters for the right to publicly perform their music. As we will hear from some of our witnesses today, the exemption for broadcasters is not only grossly unfair to performing artists, it also creates an unlevel playing field that disadvantages innovative audio services such as Pandora. Whatever the rationale may have been in the past, there's no reason in today's environment that over-the-air broadcasters should be allowed to play music without compensating the artists that perform it. Although we're still learning the full details of the agreement between Clear Channel and Big Machine, I'm encouraged that a major broadcasting group has acknowledged that performing artists should be compensated for their use for their music on over-the-air radio.
Hello. Can you hear me? I'm talking to you, whether you believe me or not. You shouldn't believe me, because my voice is not here or there, it's everywhere. You can't see me. When my voice is audible, you are listening to a strange materialization, as strange as the electromagnetic invisibility of my voice. Perhaps. Perhaps the materialization is even stranger. You hear me, but I am not here. I'm everywhere. And I'm 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I cannot count how many voices I am. Me. My voice. I'm dispersed. My radio voice is not my voice, if you know what I mean. But then, what are you listening to? My voice does not belong to me. My voice is not my private property, but at the same time, it belongs to nobody. It can never be property. It is not like the commodities that you buy, but it can become yours as a gift. Even then, it is not your voice. It is not private property. It belongs to nobody. Sure, you can tape my voice. You can play it endlessly. You can bootleg this voice. But the voice as a radio voice is more than a taped voice. It's a broadcast, dispersed, an electromagnetic voice. It is more than any recorder can record. It is more than a single person can grasp. It is not one voice that could be recorded. It is one voice in a plurality of uncountable situations.
What time are you listening to Turn on the News? 3103.9's radio show about the radio. That was The Future of Radio Art from Linga, from the Radio Territory CD. Before that, we heard The Future of Audio from the U.S. Congress, a hearing Wednesday, June 6th. Front of the U.S. Congress called The Future of Audio. It started with Republican Cliff Stearns from Florida and included several other committee members talking about the future of audio. I'm Ray Bradbury, the author, passed this week. And he has several radio links. Jennifer Waits at Radiosurvivor.com, in fact, rounds up some of his radio passages in Fahrenheit 451 and also mentions his recent Bradbury 13 radio series from the BBC's Radio 4 Extra. There's also many other, The Martian Chronicles, Dandelion Wine, and other radio versions of his novels. But let's quote Jennifer Waits now at Radiosurvivor.com. She says, Radio Bus should also pick up a copy of Bradbury's novel Fahrenheit 451 in order to see some spot-on predictions about the dangers of personal electronics. In the book, protagonist Guy Montag is married to a woman who blocks out the world by listening to a thimble-sized seashell radios that fit in her ears. One notable passage reads, quote, His wife stretched on the bed, uncovered and cold, like a body displayed on the lid of a tomb, her eyes fixed to the ceiling by invisible threads of steel, immovable. And in her ears, the little seashells, the thimble radios tampered tight in an electronic ocean of sound, of music and talk, and music and talk coming in on the shore of her unsleeping mind. The room was indeed empty. Every night the waves came in and bore her off on their great tides of sound, floating her, wide-eyed, toward morning. There had been no night in the last 2 years that Mildred had not swum that sea, had not gladly gone down it for the third time. Unquote. The novel portrays a future in which books are banned. It stands to reason that in this landscape, radio and television are not heroic characters, as they are part of the culture which eschews books and literature. Another line from Fahrenheit 451 describes a vomiting radio. Quote, The train radio vomited upon Montag in retaliation, a great tonload of music made of tin, copper, silver, chromium, and brass. The people were pounded into submission. They did not run. There was no place to run. The great air train fell down its shaft in the earth. Right here is an excerpt from one of those BBC radio dramas, Bradbury 13. This is Night Call Collect, first aired April 9th, 1984, and introduced by Ray Bradbury himself.
This is Ray Bradbury. Join me for the next 30 minutes on a tour through time and space. Come along to the far future. Follow me into a strange past with stories that almost could be or might have been. Real or unreal, this is Bradbury 13. He sat silently. He sat, a man 80 years old. He sat in an empty house, on an empty street, in an empty town, on the empty planet Mars. He sat as he had sat for 60 years, waiting. Outside, a Martian wind raged, shaking the telephone poles and causing the wires to sing in chorus. Inside, on the table in front of him, lay a telephone that had not rung for a long, long time. Until now. Ray Bradbury's Night Call Collect.
The wind. That infernal wind never stops. Never leaves me a night's peace. Blowing through the wires all over town. It That's impossible. No, no, I am alone in an empty house on an empty planet. No!
Barton? Barton, are you there?
Barton? Why, yeah, that's me.
Barton?
What?
Wait. Barton?
Barton? No, it can't be. It can't be. There. It's done. No. Not again. It's not possible. Who's there?
Barton?
Yes, yes. This is Barton.
Well, well. Do you know who this is?
Oh, what do you mean, who? The first call I've had in a lifetime, and you want to play games?
Oh, sorry. How stupid of me. Of course you wouldn't recognize your own voice on the telephone. Nobody ever does. It's like the first time you heard your voice recorded on a tape recorder. You were disappointed in the nasal, affected quality you heard.
What are you talking about?
Barton. This is Barton.
Brad Knickerbocker at the Christian Science Monitor and many other publications are reporting about new evidence about Amelia Earhart. And where she ended up in the Pacific on her famous early air voyage attempt across the Pacific, and where she was never found, and no evidence was really found. But scientists have now worked with 120 radio signals that were reported at the time. They've determined that 57 of those 120 signals are credible and possible Amelia Earhart signals. And triangulating those with new equipment that hasn't been before available to triangulate where a signal's coming from based on where the signal's received, they've now led it that Amelia Earhart's position must have been Nakumoro Island. And indeed, later evidence was found at Nakumoro Island of not of plane crash, but of Western relics and things that might have been on a plane, cups and such. So it's pretty sure that is what happened on July 2nd, 1937. I'm Tom Burr. You're listening to Turn on the News, a radio show about radio. We just heard first from the BBC Radiophonic Workshop Ocean, then Bernard Herrmann with Prelude Outer Space Radar.
Pulsing out from the transmitter tower into the tubes and coils behind your radio dial.
So here's this sort of radiophonic form of radiance where you have these technologies and people connected to other people. It is not merely a product of radio and radio technologies and other 20th century technologies, but it goes back to sort of pre-Socratic philosophers and their attempt to figure out exactly sort of how we're connected.
We don't want ADJs, we don't want to program our station, we don't want to do news.
They continued to broadcast, and these facilities were attacked by armed gunmen who basically shot up the transmitters and other equipment and silenced that public radio TV system that the people were using.
All IDs are up, and stand fake. All right, let you know that you're violating R-15 or you. Yeah, have a nice day.
We are at war with our own government. It's no longer a democracy, and that in order to win any war, you need to be able to shoot, move, and communicate. And even if you can't shoot or move, if you can communicate, you can keep your eyes from getting shot, and you know, understand how to move safely. And I really feel like communication is the key point to winning this war.
What we've seen is the radio and television industry taken over by basically a military-industrial complex that sees it as a weapon and is not going to allow that weapon in the hands of people who will challenge the power and authority of the interest that be.
It could be.
Well, in very few cases, if at all, really an incident out in Iowa.
Look, gentlemen, practice these words in front of the mirror. Although we are constantly experiencing currently, there is no direct evidence that links cell phone usage to brain cancer.
The technology to make your own radio station is getting cheaper and cheaper.
We've seen both in Afghanistan and in Iraq, one of the first things that the government does is start their own micro pirate radio station. I guarantee you they never went to any bureaucracy in Afghanistan or Iraq and requested permission to begin broadcasting their messages across that country.
People have the radio without messages, silent radio, television without images.
controllers here looking very carefully at the situation. Obviously a major malfunction. We have no downlink.
Tune in to Turn on the News daily from 3103.9.org. You can go to newsroom.3103.9.org for links to anything you might hear here, including links to international radio art, radio news, media news, links, and more. Go to 3103.9 and newsroom.3103.9.org for everything you want to know about transmission arts. And to hear Turn on the News daily.
The preceding show was produced by Free 103.9 at the WGXE studios in New York.